This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. If you were listening to the radio in 1966, it was a true hodgepodge of what was then considered popular music. And right up there with the Supremes and Simon and Garfunkel and Frank Sinatra and even the Beatles was this guy. Yes, that signature Tijuana brass sound. Herb Alpert had no Latin roots, but wanted to recreate the sound he'd heard at the bullfights in Tijuana. When he decided to overdub his trumpet on two different tape machines, he captured it. And he captured more than that. Whipped Cream and Other Delights was the number one album in the country in 1965, remaining on the charts for 3 years. In 1966, the Tijuana Brass sold over 13 million records, outselling the Beatles.
I started playing when I was 8, and I was earning a living on weekends playing. I love playing.
What happened when you were 8?
Well,
what had you seen or heard that made you say, I want to pick up a trumpet and start playing?
Well, yeah, I was really fortunate. In my elementary school, they had a band appreciation class, and they had this table filled with various instruments, and I was able to just pick one up. And
where were you going to school then?
Melrose Elementary School in Los Angeles. Yeah.
And what did your dad do?
Ladies coats and suits.
Yeah,
that was
he's in the clothing business.
He was in the clothing business. He was a Schneider, you know. My brother was a professional drummer. My sister played piano, mother violin, and my dad played mandolin by ear.
So your parents were musical?
Very musical.
But it wasn't their profession?
No, not at all.
What did your parents think about when you were so devoted to music? Were they discouraging you of doing that, or they encouraged you?
My dad wasn't so crazy about it. He thought, what do you want to play in sawdust pits the rest of your life? That was his image of it.
Okay now, everybody clap.
The Brass, as they were called, toured often as a kind of review.
In the 60s, we played some college affairs in Upper California. Woody Allen opened the show for us as a stand-up comic.
No.
Yeah.
It wasn't just concert-style music. You had comics open for you in different kinds of...
Yeah. Woody opened for us. George Carlin opened for us. Jim Carrey opened for us. I go back a ways, man. I'm older than dirt, you know.
Well. At the time, he didn't know it. But Alpert was only just beginning an extraordinary career as a musician, eventually earning 5 number one hits, 8 Grammys, 14 platinum albums, and 15 gold. However, those achievements might be seen as a kind of act one to his later, unimaginably successful career as a music producer.
We've only just begun to live.
In 1962, with his friend Jerry Moss, Alpert founded what would become the world's largest independent record label, A&M Records. They signed such artists as The Carpenters, Sheryl Crow, Janet Jackson, and The Police.
Roxanne, you don't have to put on the red light. Those days are over.
Alpert and Moss started the whole thing with $200 and a handshake, ultimately selling A&M to PolyGram Records in 1990 for $500 million. Today, Alpert's a prolific sculptor and painter and continues to make music, touring occasionally. He's 76 and still as handsome as ever. Herb Alpert has always had matinee idol looks, but he never took up acting.
Let me tell you something. When I was in high school, I was working at a gym. This agent came up to me and says, man, you look like you should be in the movies. So I said, well, what can you do for me? He set me up with the people at Paramount. I auditioned. They said I was a little green. So I started taking lessons. I studied with Jeff Corey and also Leonard Nimoy. And I realized I didn't have it. I'm passionate about playing the horn.
What's the music scene like in Los Angeles then for a young guy who wants to play?
Well, it was quite different. It was Shaboom, Shaboom, 60-Minute Man, and those type of songs that were kind of popular at the time. I had a great experience, though. I was partners with Lou Adler at the time.
How did you become partners with him?
Well, he was dating my ex-wife.
Oh, Hollywood.
Yeah.
I forgot we're talking about L.A.
Lou was writing poetry, and I started writing some you know, music to his poetry. And he's kind of a knock-on-every-door type of guy, and I'm the shy one. So we got this job at Keen Records in Los Angeles and started working for Bumps Blackwell, who was the producer for Sam Cooke. And Lou and I became really close friends with Sam Cooke. We wrote Wonderful World together with him.
Right.
He was really special. He had something very unusual. He was a very unpretentious guy, but very elegant.
What did he teach you?
Sam had this number one record, You Send Me.
Sure.
And his follow-up was I Love You for Sentimental Reasons. And so the owner of this company that I was working for was like an amateur piano player. So Sam was recording, goes into the control room and starts listening to a playback. I was there with this owner. And the owner walks up to Sam and says, Sam, you know, in bar 12, you can put in a whoa-whoa. And in bar 35, you can put in another whoa. You know, he had the sheet music. And Sam looked at the guy and says, Jack, you can't just put in a whoa-whoa whenever you want, man. You got to feel it.
Yeah.
He says, man, you're listening to a cold piece of wax, and it either makes it or it don't. You know, he broke it right down to the nub.
For me, what's interesting about your career is not just virtuosic musicianship, but you go on to become a very serious and, like, incredibly successful producer. Did you feel, when you met those people, did you have that skill as well?
Oh, no. I didn't have any skills.
You didn't?
No.
Producing-wise?
No, producing-wise, I didn't even think about it. I had an experience at a place called the Annex in Los Angeles, a recording studio. And I was watching a reasonably famous producer produce a record. So the musicians are rehearsing. Plaz Johnson was a saxophone player. He was the saxophone player that played on the Pink Panther.
For Mancini.
Yeah. They rehearsed. Plaz played this incredible solo. The producer gets on the horn and says, okay, Plaz, beautiful. Just play the same thing again. And Plaz said, what do you mean? He said, just play that solo again. I loved it. He says, did you record it? He says, no, but you know what you did. Just play it again. I thought, well, I can do this. This is...
Always be rolling.
Well, I always do that.
Always be rolling.
Oh, yeah.
Now, great success for you with Tijuana Brass and great success for you recording albums. And when does producing become something, if ever, that was as important to you? I mean, A&M is not some mom and pop shop. You and Moss set up a huge company that you sold to PolyGram for an enormous amount of money. Because you strike me as a guy that's a real artist. You're painting and you're sculpting and you're playing music. When does it start to really take over the business side in A&M?
Well, I surround...
Would you let Jerry do that?
Well, exactly. And I surround myself with, really quality people, people that can do things that I can't. And I'm a right brain guy. You know, I'm 85% on the right side of my brain, so... Business was always a little funny for me. You know, Jerry and I always discussed the big, broad stroke of A&M, but, the little incidental things that happen on a daily basis, I wasn't interested in.
Front of the house, back of the house.
Yeah, exactly.
What was it about Jerry that you think it lasted so long and was so successful?
He's just a really good guy. He's an honest, he has a lot of integrity. He doesn't lie. Sounds strange, but we never had a contract. Jerry and I had A&M on a handshake.
Yeah.
And the only time we ever signed a contract was when we sold to PolyGram.
Now, during that period when you're producing, I know nothing about how records are made, which must be just completely unrecognizable now from what it was back in 65, technically.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
I did an album called Rewhipped. Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah,
I'm your PR man.
Thank you. The guy who got the concept for this album, got a bunch of young producers together to redo the Whipped Cream and Other Delights album. So they sent me music files on a CD or on a DVD or through the net I would put my trumpet on, put the trumpet on a CD because it's all time-coded, send the CD back to them. They would slip it right into their master recordings. And I never met these guys. I spoke to one that
the ultimate internet dating.
These guys could have been in Afghanistan. It would have worked the same way.
Yeah. What was it like before?
Well,
when you recorded Whipped Cream and Other Delights, which is obviously one of the most famous records ever made, where'd you record that album?
Well, it was recorded at Gold Star Studios in Los Angeles. But, you know, prior to that, my first recorder was a wire recorder. I had a Webcor wire recorder. So if you wanted to, you know, intercut some things, you need a soldering iron.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Do you feel that all this technology and all of the power that comes with that, has it made people lazy? Like people can't get in a room and they just can't play a song all the way through anymore?
No, I don't think it makes them lazy. I think it gives them too many options. You know, now with the digital, you know, setup, you have umpteen tracks and you can just keep going and keep going. And then you can tune them up and you can shift it around, take something that was happening at the end of a song and move it up to the front. Too many options. I think it takes some of the heart away.
Yeah, I mean, I also wonder, people say, what's the difference between, you know, theater and film? And more and more, the technical cost of these highly technical fields, whether it's filmmaking, television, recorded music, it's expensive. And so they want everybody, it's almost to the point now where they don't care how you feel about the experience. Because I'll stand there and I'll say, well, I want to do another take, man, and I want to feel it, you know. I want to do this whole speech on page 2, all the way to the bottom of page 4. It's like a ski run. I want to ski that hill all the way to the bottom without falling. And everybody looks at you and goes, we don't have time for that,
yeah, man.
We got to get out of here.
Yeah, I can relate.
That's the way the music business is now?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it depends on, you know, what artists you're talking about.
Who's someone that you recorded that you sat there and you were like, wow, man, this is really a thrill for me as an artist to watch this man or woman get
Well,
going.
There are a lot of, I mean, we have such incredible artists. With
Name them. A couple that you dug the most.
Cat Stevens was unusually special.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come. And I believe it could be something good has begun.
Cat has something magical.
You guys signed him.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, he was so passionate and so, you know, the lyrics and so unusual. He had his own interpretation of all these songs. And he was beautiful.
I remember those records, boy.
And, of course, you know, the Police. Sting just writes a great song. And when we saw them, you know, Sting was bouncing around the stage like he was on a pogo stick. They were great to watch. And, of course, I had an unusual experience with the Carpenters. I signed the Carpenters. And
on my iPod, I have The Carpenters, I have Sting, and then I have, hold on a second, I have Cat Stevens on my iPod.
Oh, yeah.
You got a lot of my money, man.
Oh,
A&M got a lot of my money.
Well, you know, in 1960, this is an interesting story, if you want to hear this story.
Go, tell me.
In 1967, I was doing a special for NBC. Jack Haley Jr. was directing. He said, why don't you sing a song? I said, well, if I can find the right song, I'll give it a go. So, you know, I go through my Rolodex and I call Burt Bacharach. So I said, Burt, is there a song that you have that you think I could handle, that you have tucked away in your drawer someplace, or you find yourself whistling in the morning, or, you know, a tune that haunts you? Well, 3 days later, he sent me This Girl's in Love with You.
Sure.
You see, this guy, this guy's in love with you. Yes, I'm in love. Who looks at you the way I do?
When I watched the video this morning.
Of what?
Of you singing the song.
Oh, okay. Then you saw my ex-wife then.
That's your ex-wife, sure.
Cute, wasn't she?
Yeah. Yeah.
I record the song. I fly to New York so Hal David would change the lyric to suit me. As I'm walking out of Hal's door, I said, Hal, is there a song that you think I might be able to handle, or song that you have tucked away in the drawer, the same yarn I gave Bert? 2 days later, he sent me Close to You, which was going to be the follow-up to This Guy's in Love with You. I recorded it in the studio. I'm listening to the playback, and my engineer friend, Larry Levine, rest his soul, looked at me and says, "Man, you sound terrible singing this song. Forget it." I lost my confidence. I put that thing in the drawer. When I signed the Carpenters in 1970, they had an album that didn't sell. I mean, the first album was zero. And people
describe the first album. Why did the first? Was it too reliant on Richard Carpenter?
No. It had Karen, but it was very soft. It was very delicate and very. It wasn't really radio friendly.
Got it.
So a year later, I gave him "Close to You." They recorded it, and it was really light again. I said, "This we need a little bit more energy on this one," because Karen thought she was a drummer. I mean, she played drums and she was good. But she wanted to record, and when I listened to the recording, I said, "No, it's a little too light. You know, we need some more oomph." They recorded it again, and it still wasn't quite there. And so, finally, we got the Wrecking Crew. I don't know if you know that name. Those are these guys that did most of the sessions in L.A. The Hal Blaine on drums, and Tommy Tedesco on guitar, and Carol Kaye. The third recording was The Charm.
Why do stars fall down from the sky? Every time you walk by, just like me, they long to be close to you.
What's the difference? How do they get there? For you as a person who has this ear, this gift, something happens for you like an alchemy where you just go, "That's it, they got it."
Well, yeah, you know.
How do they get there? How do you help them get there? Or do you?
You try to flag them down to the runway, you know. That's what we did with most of our artists. You know, we didn't try to sign the beat of the week. We tried to get, you know, like I was saying, the Cat Stevens and the artists we chose were artists that just had their own little identity, which we loved. And the Carpenters had that. I mean, I signed them because it wasn't the type of music that I normally listened to, but they were so sincere about it. Yeah. They were so passionate about the music.
Unapologetic.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. One of the most clarion voices I've ever heard in my life.
Well, when I heard the original tape, you know, and the original tape was presented to me like, "Psst, buddy, do you want to hear a tape?" You know, and somebody handed me a tape through the gates at A&M, and I sat down in my couch in my office at A&M, and I did what I usually do, put on the tape. The speakers were on the floor about 10 feet in front of me. Closed my eyes, and it felt like Karen's voice was sitting right next to me on the couch. So I was just really intrigued to meet them, and when I did, I just realized this is the real deal.
So you build this big company. You know, you got a great record mm-hmm. company, you and Jerry. And then the time comes, and aside from deal making, and aside from PolyGram making it well worth your while, what was it like in terms of the decision to let it go and to sell the company?
Well, I felt something coming. I felt the music file sharing, and something just felt like the time is right. It was tough.
What year was that?
Well, in 1990. Most of these companies were run by these big corporations, and you know they were throwing millions and millions of dollars around for new artists. And we felt that, you know, you make one mistake at our size and then your ship is sinking. So we just thought it was time. And originally we were just going to sell 49%, which we held on to for a long time. And then they said, "Look, we'd like to gobble the whole thing." And I thought, "Well, what can I do to throw in a little something? I'd like my catalog back." Herb Alpert, Tijuana Brass, and Herb Alpert single catalog plus Lonnie Hall's catalog. And I got it.
Did you? I mean, that's what all artists crave, right?
Yeah.
Is to control their own music.
I wanted it back, and they agreed to it. We signed the contract. And
you made the deal and sold the company.
Yeah.
To them. Was painting and sculpting becoming more important in your life right at the same time you decided to get rid of A&M to PolyGram?
Not really.
Were those two things intersecting? No.
No. I've been painting for 42 years. I started painting in 1970. I'm not a Sunday painter. I'm not a Sunday artist. I do it every day. You know, traveling in the 60s with the Tijuana Brass around the world, I used to go to museums, and I'd go to the modern art section for whatever reason. That just appealed to me. And, you know, I see these paintings, like a black painting with a purple dot or something hanging on the wall, and I think, let me try something like that.
Yeah.
I wasn't doing it to think something would come of it. I'll tell you what's great, and I know, Alec, you know about this. It's just, there's something about being an artist, being a musician, being a painter, being a sculptor. When you're doing it, you're in the exact moment of your life. And that's rare, you know. When you're not in that mode, you're thinking about yesterday or tomorrow or some other hazarai that really doesn't make any sense. But when you're doing it, man, it just feels so right on the moment.
I feel that way when I'm on my boat.
Well, cool.
I don't paint, and I don't. I wish I could paint.
Well, you should try it. I mean, when I started painting, I painted like a monkey. You know, I would just squeezed some paint on a canvas and moved it around.
Like a kid.
Yeah.
You had no training.
No training. I didn't know what I was doing. But I think there's an advantage to that. I think when you're an amateur and you're just fooling around, you have infinite possibilities. You know, if you go to a professional, they'll tell you what not to do and what to do and how to do it and blah, blah, blah. And I didn't know about that. I just did whatever. I'm always going for a feel. You know, it's I do that in music and sculpting and painting. It's like I'm not looking for something that's going to, you know, excite my eyes. I want something that excites my soul, you know, something that really resonates.
I'm assuming there's no preference between paint and canvas and sculpture for you. You enjoy them both equally.
I do.
I got a copy from your office of the Black Totems exhibit and the work you've done. Now, these are obviously immense pieces. They're enormous pieces.
They're 18-footers in bronze. And
are these exclusively for people who have cliffside homes in Malibu with acres of land?
I'm not interested in really selling.
I'm just saying they're big. They're big.
Yeah, they're huge.
I think of my homes in New York and on Long Island. I would be interested in buying the lower 4 feet of this one. If we could cut this into sections, actually, that would be that would work quite well for me.
Oh,
I don't have 18 feet in Manhattan on the far side, but they're absolutely stunning. This is Alec Baldwin, and I'm talking with Herb Alpert. More in a minute. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing, today talking with Herb Alpert. What is music for you now? I know that's the ultimate cliched question, but how do you view the music world now beyond zeros and ones and the digital and everything? You must be sitting home, and sometimes you sit there and go, wow, that sounds great. I really dig that.
Well, you know, I have really varied tastes. So I love classical music. I love, you know, listening to Ravel.
Who are your favorite composers?
Ravel. Yeah, I love Ravel. Actually, Ravel taught me a lesson. Actually, I was going to SC for a few moments. I was in the orchestra there. And they were playing pictures at an exhibition. You know, I was in the orchestra playing that.
The Mussorgsky.
Yeah, Mussorgsky wrote it. Ravel
arranged it.
Good for you. And they were playing the last movement of Great Gate of Kiev, you know. And I was, like, so intrigued with the sound of the orchestra. I was leaning forward, listening to everybody, and it sounded like, wow, it's like natural stereo. And I forgot to come in. I forgot to come in on my part. Right at that moment, I thought, hey, you know, this isn't for me. What I really want to do is just close my eyes and play. I love Miles Davis. I love Louis Armstrong. I love those guys that just, you know, create. I want to try doing that. And so I started, you know, working on jazz, which is a very specific language. I mean, just because you want to play jazz doesn't mean you can play jazz.
Had you been asked to score a lot of film? Did you pass up? You must have been asked to score tons of films.
I did the title song of
Casino Royale.
Casino Royale with Burt Bacharach, but that was about it. I don't think that's my thing. I didn't feel it.
You would have been great at that.
Maybe. My wife thinks I should still, you know, pursue that. But, you know, I had an experience. This is like a little different aside. But I was in the studio recording the Going Places album. And the brass was already going crazy. I mean, we were selling, you know.
It was going well.
Yeah, it was going well. And I get a call from my partner. I said, and the album wasn't finished yet. I get a call from Jerry, and he says, we just have advanced orders of 1,400,000. And I got depressed. Felt like, gee, you know, if people love the album, buy it. If you don't, you know, it was a strange feeling.
Why?
I know it sounds a little...
But why?
I just didn't want to be prejudged. I mean, I wanted people to listen to the album, hear it, and if they liked it, buy it.
Purity is what you seem to be after.
Yeah, I don't mean to be too altruistic, but I mean, Yeah, I was looking for that real ride.
Until we find a better word, we'll say purity.
Okay. You know, I was looking for that ride. Yeah. You like it, buy it. I love it.
Where did you meet your second wife?
Okay.
Who you're obviously madly in love with.
Yeah, so you don't know that story. All right.
Let's hear it.
This is good. So, you know.
Musicians in love is always a good story.
In 1966, I auditioned Brazil 66, Sergio Mendes.
Sergio Mendes.
Brazil 66. Lonnie was the lead singer. Jerry and I signed them to a long-term contract. This was when the brass was really cooking. And we hired them to open the show for us. So they were playing for 18,000 people at a time. Lonnie and I became friends. We were just really good friends. She's very unusual. She's from Chicago. She can sing in Portuguese like a native. Beautiful voice. And
she loves music.
Oh,
do you have a similar kind of a, I don't want to say passion for music, but do you have a similar ethic for music? Is she?
Oh, completely. She loves jazz. She loves, you know, all kind of music, but... We are really the opposites, you know. I'm really quiet. I'm really kind of like a low-key type of guy.
Yeah.
She's more, you know, has more energy and more zip-zap.
More outgoing.
Yeah, more outgoing.
Who makes the dinner reservations out there in California for you? Who's picking the restaurants? Your wife.
No, she doesn't. I do that.
Do you really?
Yeah.
I just want to look at my wife and I want to go, whatever you say, baby. What do you want to have? You want Indian food? You got it, baby. I don't want to have to make those decisions. I got other stuff I got to think about.
Yeah, no, it's kind of mutual with us. I mean, she's, you know, I met her at a time and we became friendly and she was able to identify my neurosis.
Which is what?
Well, you know, at the time I was going through a divorce and I couldn't play the horn.
How did that manifest itself?
Well, took a trip to Europe. We had a little time off. When I got back, we had some obligations to go back to Europe and do some concerts. And I had like 2 or 3 weeks to get back in shape, and I just couldn't do it. My tongue wouldn't go in the right place. I was all bottled up. I was stiff. My neck was tight. Couldn't make a sound out of the horn. It was really painful. You know, I was really upset about the divorce, and I had, you know, a bottle of Melanta at my side there.
you were unhappy.
There was a hole in the stomach, you know, and I just wasn't happening. And I just couldn't execute. I couldn't play the horn.
How long did that last?
Oh, it lasted for years.
Really?
Yeah, it did. It finally wound
what years
its
were those?
Way down. Well, 1969, 70, 71, 72.
So right after you have this huge crest of the greatest score as a performer of your life, you kind of crash and you don't. You literally didn't play.
Well, I played, but it was painful. I had an experience in Germany. I did, you know, had this obligation to play these concerts in Europe. I was in Germany, in Frankfurt, and I was on the stage, painfully playing. And all of a sudden, I had this out of body experience. All of a sudden, I was in the third row, looking at me. You know, I was thinking to myself, "Well, gee, this guy is usually pretty comfortable on the stage." But when he's, you know, off the stage and he's in a room of, you know, at a party or whatever, he's totally out of control, which I felt I was at the time. I said, when I get back to Los Angeles after this series of concerts, I'm going to either throw this horn away, sell A&M, do whatever. I just want to find out who I am and why I'm here. I mean, everybody's looking for the same thing, I think, a life of purpose and meaning. I mean, without that, what else is there?
Yeah.
Luckily, I met a teacher in New York here. His name was Carmine Caruso. He played violin. He played saxophone. He didn't play trumpet, but he taught a lot of trumpet players. He likened the musician to an athlete, and you had to sync your body muscles to rhythm. And over a period of time, I just kind of unwound this terrible problem I had.
How long did it take?
It took, before I was really comfortable, probably 8 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you do that when you started painting?
Well, no, that's an interesting question. You know,
but you said you started painting since 1970.
Yeah, I did.
And you started to lose your mojo horn-wise in 69.
Yeah, right.
Did painting and sculpting come into your life as you found you didn't want to play the horn?
Well, sculpting came in later. Painting was a big relief.
You had to have somewhere to put that energy.
Exactly. It was a rough period for me.
I've been there, man.
Yeah.
I've been there. And mine is a result of a divorce, too, you know?
Yeah.
And not like I thought I needed to be, to stay in that marriage, but it was the way that those things end sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
You just sit there and go, you're like, this is not,
Yeah, not what you planned it.
Well, not what I bargained for. Like, we can, well, let's hit rewind here and go back and try to figure this out, man.
And hit delete.
Yeah, let's, we gotta do this again. When did you marry your current wife? What year?
74.
So 74. Yeah. So during this time, is years of you not feeling great, and then you meet her, and you meet this woman who's obviously the love of your life.
Right. But at the same time, I was still playing. I was, like I said, I was playing the horn.
You're forcing yourself to play.
Well, forcing myself. In 74, we had a command performance for the Queen of England. We played there, and the band sounded...
Tijuana Brass?
Yeah. Band sounded great. And then meet Prince Charles, who said, oh, you have all your records in the den. You know, I couldn't picture the den.
Yeah.
Met the Queen, very lovely, nice smile. This was in 1974. I was feeling pretty puffed up. I felt good about that. So go out the back door, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people there just waiting for the various artists that were on the show. And this, as I'm walking through the crowd, I hear these two ladies talk. I don't know that chap. Who is that chap? And her friend said, I think that's Sergio Mendez. You know? After feeling so good.
There. I got to get over here more often, man. I got to get these people straightened out. They don't know me from Sergio Mendez.
Yeah.
I think that's a great thing that you're someone who you weren't feeling all that great at that time in your life, but you fooled the King and the Queen of England, man.
I didn't fool them. The band sounded
good.
No,
I'm just saying that you got it done.
Yeah. But, you know, there's something about, when you're good at something, you can fake it and nobody really knows, you know?
Yeah, right. Now, for you, who's a horn player that you take your hat off? Who's one? Just give me one. Just really dug listening to.
Well, Miles Davis. I love Miles. You know, Miles was the real thing.
Why?
Well, because he was completely authentic.
Right.
He was just playing the music that was coming out of him. No compromise. He understood space, you know, the silence that happens between the notes, you know, he understood that. And I think he was the key, jazz musician of the 20th century. I've met some really incredible jazz musicians in my day. And each one has their own little take on how to do it.
Yeah.
Stan Getz was like a brother to me.
Yeah.
I produced two albums with Stan, and he played this one song that was just, man, goosebumps were flying up my back. And I said, man, what are you thinking when you're playing? And he says, well, I think like I'm in front of the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem and I'm davening.
Really?
Stan, man.
Yeah.
Oh, he was great, man. I love this guy. He wore his stuff right close to the surface. I had an experience with Getz where, you know, I did these albums and he said, can I do anything for you? I said, yeah, man, how about giving me some bebop lessons? He says, sure. He says, how honest you want me to be? I said, I'm just trying to get up to my own water level. I didn't play with Charlie Parker like you did. I just wanted to see how far I can take this thing. He says, fine. I'm in my studio at home, and he's sitting down. I said, you think for one I should work on the 2-5-1 chords in every key, which is page one, if they teach at Berkeley. I mean, that's how they, you know, they start this thing. 2-5-1 is in all pop songs. It's just one of those things. I said, do you think I should work on this in every key? The 2-5-1 chords? You know what he said? What's that? He didn't think like that. I mean, those old-timers didn't play off of that shit that they're teaching at school, you know?
What do you think made Sinatra Sinatra?
Oh, man. Very musical.
He really was.
Smart.
He was grateful to the songwriters.
Oh, yeah.
And the musicians whom he knew they made him.
Oh, he
brought what he brought, but...
He was a cut above, man. The guy was... He was magic. And plus, the sound in his voice was beautiful. His timing. But I learned a great lesson. You know, when things started happening for me, my ex-wife was friends with Nancy Sinatra, and I met Frank, and I stayed at his house. And then we flew to Las Vegas. Anyway, after the show, Frank comes up to me. He says, you want to play some Baccarat? I said, I don't know how to play, but I'll go with you. he sits down at the baccarat table. I'm standing behind him. And in 20 minutes, he must have won around $30,000. I don't know. And Nancy was standing right next to me. So every time he won a pot, he'd throw off like 10 $100 bills to Nancy. So she had this pile, it looked like a bowling ball in her hands of $100 bills. And so Frank gets up abruptly and he just leaves, you know. And Nancy looks at me and says, "Here, Herbie, go take some of this and go gamble." And I looked at this pile. I said, "What do you mean take? You want me to take a half a pound? What are you talking about?"
Yeah.
And I realized at that point, man, I'm never going to treat money like that. I'm going to, you know, honor it in a whole different way. It's not,
yeah.
It can be that frivolous.
Herb Alpert established the Herb Alpert Foundation in the 1980s, giving away money his way ever since. In 2007, he gave $30 million to form the Herb Alpert School of Music at UCLA.
I love music. I think music needs to survive. I think jazz needs to survive. It's a great American legacy. It's such an important ingredient for a kid's health, you know, and I think through that they learn discipline, and which can help them in the academics, so it's just a natural. It should be a core subject.
Do you teach? Do you go over there and guest teach and so forth?
No, I don't, but I, you know, I'm not. That's really not my strong suit.
I think they would be very happy for you to show up, though, wouldn't they?
Well, they do.
Isn't that your great gift, that you just have to play and it's all there?
I think my great gift is that I have my own personality on the horn. A lot of musicians are trying to track Miles Davis or try to track Charlie Parker or try to play like. You know, I'm just trying to play like myself, and that's, I think, what everybody should be going for, their own unique voice. It's been a nice ride. I feel thankful.
Herb recently finished a sold-out two-week run at the Carlisle Hotel with his wife, singer Lonnie Hall. And I mean sold out. He couldn't get me any tickets. This is Alpert and Hall performing I Feel You.
Just another afternoon on the sidewalks of London. All the grey and rainy days run together, hidden in the streets of stone. Suddenly, I'm not alone. I feel you. I feel you. Every time I think I've lost you, it seems like you find me, blowing through me like the winds of December. Though you've gone away so far, still I turn and there you are. I feel you. I feel you. I feel you beside me, my head on your shoulder, your fragrance, your laughter, your touch. I'm lost in remembering reasons I miss you so much. How could I ever think about a lifetime that happens without you? Even if my only hope is a memory, please don't let us be apart. Wrap yourself around my heart. Let me feel you. Thank you.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Our podcast comes from WNYC Radio.